Good morning. I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Stop and frisks by police. GoFundMes for funeral costs. The constant threat of gun violence. Growing up in East Baltimore's McKeldry Park neighborhood, Kondwani Fidel learned painful lessons about how racism was part of his reality. His latest book is part memoir, part call to action, digesting those lessons. It's called The Anti-Racist, How to Start the Conversation About Race and Take Action. It asks readers to confront systemic racism and question their role in perpetuating inequality. Kondwani Fidel is a poet, performer, and writer. His other books include the collections of poetry, Hummingbirds in the Trenches, and Raw Wounds. When we spoke last December, I began by asking what it means to be anti-racist.
I believe it has a lot to do with the way that we say things, how we act on things, and also the main part, the most important part is the policies that get put out into the world. You know, you can have someone like Abraham Lincoln, right, who takes credit for freeing the slaves, right? And the slaves in Maryland were technically free, but then it was policies in place where they couldn't get jobs. They couldn't go into certain restaurants. They just didn't have the freedom that white people, you know, have always been afforded in this country. You know what I mean? So somebody on one hand can be like, hey, I said this anti-racist thing, or hey, I'm a white guy. I never called anyone the N-word. You know what I'm saying? But you might support policies that are racist policies. You know what I'm saying? Even if you look at the war on drugs, like, you know, the way that the black community was treated was different than the way that the white community was treated. And all of those things have to coexist in order for us to, you know, truly live in an anti-racist society.
Let's dive into your story. Your grandmother, Mary, quit her job at a bank and gave up a promotion to help raise you. Tell us about her.
So my grandmother has been, you know, my legal guardian since I was a kid. My mother was pregnant with me, and, you know, she is out there in all of my work, you know what I'm saying? And she struggled with a drug addiction. My father struggled with a drug addiction. And my grandmother just knew that they weren't suitable at that time to raise any kids. You know, I was going to be their first child. So she took, she took custody of me and just literally just like laid her life down, just gave me everything that she had to offer, plus some. She dealt with a lot in this country, being a black woman. She taught me how to respect women, how to respect people. She put me in private school because she just, you know, she believed that the opportunities that were at the private schools were better than the city schools. She was just always there for me, like every step of the way, for real.
Your grandmother sacrificed in order to send you to Catholic schools, first St. Elizabeth of Hungary, then Archbishop Borders. Then you went to City College for high school. How important was school to you?
So to me, school was never really important to me. Adults said that you should go, or your parents can go to jail if you don't go. They told me to go to school because it's quote unquote the right thing to do. You know, it'll make you smart. Like, all of these things just seem hypothetical, you know what I'm saying, at that point in my life. But I got straight A's when I was in the pre-K, you know, up until like fourth grade, because my aunt Sadiq used to give me $20 for every A+ that I got on my report card. So everybody in my family and probably people at my school thought that I was in love with education, which wasn't true. I was getting good grades for the money. And, you know, around that time that my grades, you know, started slipping was because my aunt Sadiq stopped giving me money for my straight A's. And, you know, I just always thought that I hated reading. I just thought that I hated writing. But I stayed in school because the work was easy for me. And also, even the work that wasn't easy, I understood the game. I was like, yo, if you're nice to these teachers, you be respectful to them, that'll grant you opportunities to turn your work in late, come to class late. You know, you just get a different type of freedom if you are nice to them and you like participate in class when a lot of people are not even trying to do that. So I just kind of like finessed and cheated my way all the way through high school. And it came around that time when people had to start applying for college, and I didn't really know where I wanted to go. I really didn't see any importance in college except for everybody just kept saying it's the next best thing to do. but nobody's really like giving me an in-depth look into what college life is like and what I should be expecting out of it. At that point in my life, you know, I'm going through things in Baltimore with my mother addiction, my father being in prison, a lot of my homeboys was going to jail, a lot of my homeboys was getting killed. So I was like, I just want to get out of Baltimore. You know what I mean? So I just started applying to all of these colleges, and you know, I got accepted to Virginia State, and I went.
Yeah, and things really shifted for you there. Tell us about Professor Arnold Westbrook.
Yeah, so Arnold Westbrook was my English professor first and second semester freshman year. That first semester, I came in, like I say, I was a sport management major my freshman year, because I love sports growing up, but I only got in a game. Coach only put me in a game. It's like we were up by 30 points or down by 30 points. So I knew that me being in the game didn't really matter. But all of my friends growing up had like star-like talent. So I told myself that I want to go study sport management, and you know, I'll become a sport agent, and then all of my friends will go to the major leagues, or, you know, NFL, NBA. So, you know, I'm studying that at the time. Again, just believing that I don't like reading or writing. And on the Westbrook channel, his lessons through African American studies. And this is my first time being engaged, you know, with the works of Maya Angelou, Langston Hughes, Nikki Giovanni. We was just doing a lot of reading, and the things that he was assigning us to read was closer to my social context of me growing up in Baltimore than the other readings that teachers in the past was forcing me to read. And I started falling in love with reading. And I started having this realization, like, you know, you never hated reading, you just hated what your teachers in the past was forcing you to read. So sophomore year, at this point, I've been writing for some time now, you know, since my freshman year. I only shared it with, like, you know, my cousin and two of my friends.
You were writing poetry.
Yeah, so because I fell in love with reading, you know, and I, you know, poetry was one of the main things that I was reading, I told myself, like, hey, you can try this thing, so start writing. So I'm just writing these poems, and nobody knows that I'm writing except for them. Fast forward to 2013, I was a part of this mentoring organization, and they were having an event, and it was a dance organization on campus who was supposed to perform an intermission. And like last minute, they backed out and said they wasn't going to be able to do it. So we were struggling trying to figure out what we were going to place with the intermission. And I raised my hand and I said, I'll do it. And everybody looked at me like I was crazy, like, do what? And I was like, I'm going to do the intermission. I'll do some poetry. And they was like, okay, we don't have nothing to lose. So they threw me in the slot. You know, I felt scared. I was nervous. I thought I was going to throw up, you know, when it came almost time for me to get on stage. But, you know, I just decided to go through with it, got on stage. I performed a poem called True Love. And after that, you know, I got a standing ovation. And I said to myself, if this is your first time doing this and, you know, these people are cheering you on, then that means that you did an okay job. This your first time, you can only get better. So that next day I went to Gandy Hall and I changed my major from sport management to English. And I just told myself that I was just going to devote my life to writing.
This is On the Record on WIP. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with poet and author Kondwani Fidel about his latest book, The Anti-Racist, How to Start the Conversation About Race and Take Action. You write a lot about losses you've experienced, particularly family and friends lost to gun violence. And you say that what comes is a desensitization, an attitude that something's going to happen to you, you can't prevent it, a fatalism. Has that stuck with you?
That it definitely stuck with me. You know, it's thoughts that I still battle with today. But one thing that I had to realize that I just started realizing recently was that, you know, we're living in these, you know, extremely oppressive states. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's not a mystery. It's not a foreign idea. Like, we know what America is about. We know, you know, what it was built on. When I speak, I try to be clear and get people to understand the difference between pessimism and being clear. Like, if I was, you know, pessimistic, I wouldn't be doing the work that I'm doing to combat racism. But we also got to be clear, you know, like, Baltimore is going to continue to have 300 murders a year. You know what I'm saying? So us as people, you know, who are trapped in a system, it's like physically, like we can't do nothing about this long history of oppression. You know what I'm saying? And we can't do nothing with the gun culture in America. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, what would that next step look like when it comes to trying to combat this issue, right? Like, it's not like it's going to be a Batman, you know, on the streets fighting crime. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's never going to happen. But it's like, okay, we know that these things are going to happen and we can try our best to prevent them. But I feel like the next best thing that we should be trying to figure out is, okay, how do we cope with the trauma of losing loved ones? You know, because when I look at the coping mechanisms that was passed down to me from my father and his friends, and probably what was passed on to them from their parents, you know what I'm saying, and their friends, was that when somebody die, somebody get killed, you know what I'm saying, you go to the candlelight vigil, you drink some liquor, you smoke the pain away, or you pop pills to take the pain away, you know what I'm saying? And in the long run, none of these things are good for the mind, body, and soul. You know what I mean? So how do we come up with new ways, new healthy ways to deal with the trauma?
What do people who haven't experienced this kind of loss not understand about it?
I feel like one of the main things that they don't understand is that the violence that goes on in the communities like mine, they don't understand that this is, it's a systemic oppression issue. You know what I'm saying? And I feel like that's the one thing that I want people to understand. And, you know, especially the Black people in my community, many times when we're speaking about the violence, we are always blaming the shooter, you know what I'm saying, and not the system that created the shooter. So that's what I just be trying to get people to understand, because I was one of those same people that just used to blame, you know, the gun violence on the people who were pulling the trigger. But I'm like, no, this gun violence is just a symptom of oppression. It's not oppression itself, you know what I'm saying, if that makes sense.
It's a big thought. We need to take a short break here. Khandwani Fidel, author of The Anti-Racist, How to Start the Conversation About Race and Take Action, is with us. When we're back, what does it mean to do the work of unlearning racism? I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. This summer, people across the world took to the streets to protest the killing of George Floyd by Minneapolis police. His death, like the deaths of other Black men and women at the hands of police, was captured on cell phone and went viral on social media. My guest, poet and essayist Khandwani Fidel, writes about the pain of those shared images in his latest book, The Anti-Racist, How to Start the Conversation About Race and Take Action. He reflects on his experiences growing up in East Baltimore, losing friends and loved ones to gun violence, and how America's legacy of racism endures. You draw a line from the deaths of George Floyd, Freddie Gray, Michael Brown, and others to America's history of lynchings. Talk about that.
Being Black in America is having to wake up, whether you're rich or poor. Waking up every day knowing there's a fixed image of you in the minds of the producers and consumers of racist ideas, and knowing that they can act on those images and treat you accordingly, you know, however you see that that fits. You know what I'm saying? And racist cops can murder you and not get convicted of any charges and can still be labeled heroes by the American people. Even outside of what you personally deal with, you know, being Black in this country and constantly seeing public displays of racism can take a toll on you mentally. And, you know, in my book, I talk about walking down Charles Street and I seen a billboard that had George Floyd, you know, face on there. And I was like, I just wanted to go outside and get a breath of fresh air. You know what I'm saying? I didn't want my my journey to just get a fresh breath and to be political, you know what I'm saying? And after that, you know, it kind of ruined my day, you know, and it was all caused by the constant reminder, the price that we pay as Black people in this country. And, you know, in a piece, I talk about how propaganda is one of America's most useful tools when sending out messages to the masses. Public lynchings in the late 1800s and early 1900s were used as methods to maintain racial conformity by terrorizing and instilling fear in Black Americans. You understand what I'm saying? Like, they could have done these things privately, but they didn't. They did it publicly. They hung people from trees. They burnt them. They dismembered their bodies. They took pieces of their bodies home for souvenirs. They took pictures. They smiled in front of the hanging and burning bodies and sold photos as souvenirs. They invited their friends and family. It was a tradition, a celebration for them. You know what I'm saying? But they were public for one reason only, and that's to showcase what will happen to you if you are Black and you challenge white supremacy, right? And then I go on just basically like discuss how Ida B. Wells wanted to document the horrifying practices of Black lynchings during those times. And she went across seas, you know, she traveled to England to speak on, you know, the things that was going on in the South and speaking about and teaching about that white mob violence. You know, how backwards would it have been if Ida B. Wells stayed in the South and was trying to teach those who were affected by these white mob violence and these lynchings, her trying to show them pictures. Like, they don't need to see pictures of burning bodies because they smell it. They don't need to see pictures of people being lynched because that was their uncle. And you know what? They never going to see their uncle again. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't need to see pictures of dead bodies in Baltimore to know that 300 people get murdered a year. You know what I'm saying? So now we come across this new age thing where we have these phones and we have videos and people are recording people getting murdered on these videos, and they share it and be like, hey, this is bringing awareness. And I'm like, yo, we gotta be more aware and you know, how to think of more effective ways to share this information. Because if you share it to a person like me, I done seen it before. I know what it feel like. I know what it look like. I don't need to see that. You know what I'm saying? So they share these videos on social media with no real direction. And, you know, people will say something like, oh, trigger warning. You know what I'm saying? But like, okay, you say trigger warning and then show somebody with their brains blown out. Like, what is like, it was no point of the trigger warning. You know what I'm saying? And again, some people, relationships to this viral content of murders and police brutality might be different from somebody who's been directly affected by it. So, you know, I know some Black people that never had physical altercations with the police, and they don't have any friends, you know, that got, you know, murdered as teenagers. So they might view it differently than the way that I view it. You know what I'm saying? And also, again, I do believe that these things can bring awareness to a certain extent, but it's still like, I feel like aimlessly sharing these videos on the internet is basically aiding white people, the racist white people who crow over these things. It's like, you know, like now they can crow over it. Like, they don't have to go outside no more in the heat or in the cold. It's like, we just upload it on Facebook form, so they can be chilling in the crib with their kids. And they can pull up Facebook on a screen and just watch people die. They can just watch Black people die. You know what I'm saying? So
the 9 minutes, almost 9 minutes of a police knee on George Floyd's neck was painful for many people. You think it was, should not have been shared as often as it was?
I believe that there are some people in this world that never seen that up close. You know what I'm saying? I definitely believe that it was some people who saw that and said, yeah, you know, there's something wrong in this country and we should do something about it, right? But my thing is, we've seen so many videos before George Floyd. What about Eric Garner? He got choked out and murdered on camera in New York. Like, what are we talking about here? If you want to see dead Black bodies, you can find them on Google. You can find them in books. You can find them in films. You can find them on social media. Like, we don't have, like, this should not be the premium gas that's keeping the car towards equality and anti-racism. It should not be the gas that keeps pushing that.
As poet and author Kandwani Fidel On the Record on WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're speaking about his latest book, The Anti-Racist, which explores his experiences growing up in East Baltimore and connects Baltimore's challenges of segregation, gun violence, and poverty to systemic racism. Your subtitle is How to Start the Conversation About Race and Take Action. What kind of action are you aiming to spark?
Just people doing things in real life. So I know that, you know, sharing information online is helpful. You know, bringing awareness to issues going on in the world that's revolving around poor race relations, stuff is helpful. But actually physically helping people in any capacity that you have the bandwidth to do so. Perfect example, in this book, you know, I speak about several people in the Baltimore community who are helping combat racism in the best ways that they know how. I got a friend named Anthony Williams on Instagram. His name is Cool Ant, and he started a run club because he knew that he came across some information. Again, information. He became aware that, you know, Black people were dying at a disproportionate rate in, you know, the communities that we come from due to COVID. But a lot of those deaths were because of underlying health issues. And a lot of those underlying health issues comes from systemic oppression, food deserts, and it goes on. So he says, okay, cool. I'm into fitness. I can, you know, start a run club. And then out of that run club with a few others, birthed this club called Building Bodies and Bonds, where they train people in the community for free. They run, they provide healthy foods. You know what I'm saying? Something that a lot of poor people can't budget for. So that's their way that they're combating racism. Even if you look at Brittany Young, who has the organization B360, you know, she's working to decriminalize dirt bike riding with the youth. And she's also teaching, you know, young kids that, you know, if they can break down a dirt bike and put it together in their sleep. You know what I'm saying? And they are engineers, essentially. And how do I get these, you know, people to see that potential and that talent and, you know, get them on a track to probably get a job in STEM? So I believe that it all lies in what are you good at? What's your privilege? Because we all have a privilege. How can you take these things and just give it to people who aren't afforded, you know, the access that you have? Like, how do you spread the wealth that way? Because I'm not telling you to go out here and be on the front lines of a protest and get tear gas or get a rubber bullet shot in your eye. You know what I'm saying? When you might not be built for that. You know what I'm saying? That we all for the people who do want to live in an anti-racist society, I feel like that, again, like we all on a right path. You know, we just got different tasks on that path. Whatever you're good at, just find out where you fit in at and just give people the best that you have to offer. And again, you can fool me, you can fool, you know, the people around you, but you can't fool yourself and you can't fool God. You know what I'm saying? So everybody know what privilege they have. Everybody know what they have access to, and just find ways that you can get at the other people for real.
Kandwani Fidel, thank you for giving us so much to think about. Thank you.
Thank you for having me, definitely. It was a great conversation.
Kandwani Fidel's latest book is The Anti-Racist, How to Start the Conversation About Race and Take Action. We spoke in December. At the On the Record page at WIPR.org, we have links to some of Fidel's essays and poems and his calendar of upcoming events. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Glad you're with us. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.